ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's February 11, 1990, and I'm glued to the TV at my auntie's house in Nairobi, 3,000 kilometers from Johannesburg, watching the most famous political prisoner in history, Nelson Mandela, as he walks out of the prison gates, a free man.
The crowd is just catching a sight of this figure now. Yes, he's alongside Winnie Mandela, both of them raising their arms in the air.
No one has seen his face for 27 years. When Nelson Mandela was locked up by South Africa's apartheid regime in 1962, I wasn't even born yet, and he was only 44. A tall, handsome lawyer with this booming voice. And now he's an older man, 71.
Now is the time to intensify this struggle.
Mandela's image has been banned for almost 30 years, and so we drink him in, this hero of ours, this man who's kept us going. There were times, to be honest, when I wondered if Mandela really existed. He was this mythical hero who couldn't possibly be real. But here he is, free, standing in the sun, holding hands with his beloved wife, Winnie, turning up his older, wiser face to let the world see him.
To relax our efforts now would be a mistake which generations to come.
And I can't stop weeping. Mandela is free. And this means South Africa, the home I've never been allowed to visit, might soon be free as well.
Mr. Mandela told the crowd there was now a much greater recognition that South African apartheid had no future and would be replaced by democracy.
After decades of protest and boycott and activism, the movement to end apartheid in South Africa is finally on the verge of victory.
It was a historical moment. You couldn't help but hold back tears. It was an amazing moment, and it was victory.
There was complete joy. I've never seen joy like that.
I felt just an extreme sense of exhilaration, that huge luminescent smile.
You just realized you were in the presence of a noble and rare human being.
A big roar of ANC goes up from the crowd. Mr. Mandela is to walk out of this prison to freedom.
I'm Sisonke Msimang. On ABC Rewind, this is Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. It's a story for our times. In this bin fire of a world we're living in right now, we all need a story. One that reminds us that once upon a time, a bunch of regular folk stood up to a racist regime and insisted that what was happening on the other side of the world was absolutely 100% their business. It's the story of how millions of people, black and white, South African and non-South African, fought a brutal white minority government and brought it to its knees. And it's the story of the role Australia played in that fight. The story of sports fans running onto rugby and cricket pitches in protest.
Here's the fullback McGill coming in, a chance here, there's a demonstrator on the field. Demonstrator has run right through the play.
The story of people refusing to buy and sell South African goods at supermarkets, of unions boycotting, refusing to handle apartheid cargo. The story of ordinary people standing strong against injustice in their own small ways. And why am I the person telling you this story? Well, I've been thinking and writing about South Africa for a long, long time. And that's because I grew up in the anti-apartheid movement. My dad was a freedom fighter. You'll hear a lot from him in this story. And because I'm the child of a freedom fighter, I was born and raised in exile, always dreaming of South Africa. When apartheid ended, I finally got to move home, and it was miraculous. Fast forward a few decades, and I'm married to an Aussie, have a couple of kids, and then a decade ago, I left my beloved Johannesburg to live in Australia. So here I am, unraveling a story that brings together both sides of my heart. Episode 1, Spear of the Nation. This is my dad.
I was born outside Pietermaritzburg, Edendale, which was a special place, by the way. It was formed by missionaries.
His name is Mavuso. Mavuso Msimang. But I call him Baba. Baba's only 7 when South Africa's right-wing Afrikaner National Party shoots to power in 1948.
The result of South Africa's general election is worldwide news.
Although black people have been stripped of their land, can't vote, and are barred from certain professions, the Afrikaners campaign on the idea of white supremacy, and that whites are in danger of being economically displaced by the majority, black people. The National Party's election is worldwide news, because in the shadows of World War II, it's campaigned and won on a platform of racial division, apartheid.
1948, the Afrikaner nationalists got to power on the slogan of apartheid, which was Afrikaans for apartness.
Benjamin Pogrund was a white journalist during the apartheid years.
And the world was at first astonished. 3 years after World War II, the Holocaust, mass murder of Jews, you suddenly had this funny little group of people at the bottom part of the African continent who were not just preaching but practicing racial segregation and white supremacy based on the Bible.
The incoming Prime Minister, Hendrik Verwoerd, describes apartheid quite benevolently. Then again, he would. He designed it.
I'm afraid that has been misunderstood so often. It could just as easily, and perhaps much better, be described as a policy of good neighborliness. Accepting that there are differences between people, live together, aid one another, but that it can best be done when you act as good neighbors always do.
A policy of good neighborliness. When was the last time you told someone they couldn't be your neighbor because of the color of their skin? Apartheid's obsessed with racial classification. And apparently, there are 4 types of humans. White, the best. So-called colored or mixed race. They're second because at least you've got a bit of white in you. Then Indian. And finally, African. Me, at the bottom of the pile. Baba, my dad, is African. A black child living in a rural area in a country with a very complicated history and a very uncertain future.
So you felt racism because when you went to the train station, there was a coach for black people. It would be somewhere at the end of the train and the rest for white people. When you went into a park, you would find benches that were written "nie blankes," meaning not for whites. And you dared not sit on a bench that was written "blankes," which is white. We went to separate schools, and it was clear that ours were much, much poorer than those of the white people. You were not allowed in cinemas, which were reserved for whites.
Africans were not allowed to live in the city. You needed a pass to come into the city to work. Every household and every factory depended on African labor. All menial work was left to them. That's your lot in life. God said so. This is what the Prime Minister of apartheid South Africa would say.
Navi Pillay is an absolute legend who was born into a poor Durban neighborhood in 1941, the same year as Baba. She grew up classified as Indian, and against all odds, she became the first non-white female judge of South Africa's High Court, then the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and now she's a judge at the International Court of Justice.
Black and white can't marry. Certain jobs were only reserved for whites. Blacks can't do all the skilled jobs. You can never mix. So as children, the most heart-sore thing for us is the exclusion. You cannot go onto beaches. Very many of the beaches in the city were for whites only. Parks really made us sad because you couldn't go onto the swings. You know, this is a country that even detained children who had done drawings, and the authorities interpreted those drawings as critical of apartheid. And it's humiliating and hurtful. You're born in apartheid. Everybody understands it, and children do. At school, nobody, least of all the teachers, were allowed to talk about apartheid so that we remain brainwashed.
South Africa has a really complicated history. Like, really, really, really complicated. But here are the absolute basics you need to know. In the 1600s, the Dutch set up a shipping post for the Dutch East India Company, on country that's been home to the Khoi Khoi, San, and Bantu people for thousands of years. The Dutch, also known as Boers or Afrikaners, they introduced slavery. And then in the 1800s, the British decided, hey, we want a piece of the action. In 1910, after a vicious war, the Boers and the British decided, we're going to share power. They don't like each other, but they both agree that the white man is superior to the black man. Black people are subject to slavery and increasingly terrible racist policies until it reaches its awful peak in 1948, the formal introduction of apartheid. In 1952, the government makes it compulsory for every black man in the country to carry an identity document. My dad, Baba, is only 11 years old.
We used to call it a dumb pass. Dumb means stupid. It was a stupid pass defining where you could live and where we should be.
If you're not white, you have to carry the stupid pass everywhere you go.
This badge of slavery. It was a really detested document. A humiliation, but you just cannot take the risk of not having it because policemen would stop you in the street anytime. Where's your dumb pass? And if you failed to produce it, then you were locked up until you were able to get your dumb pass.
Then, a year after the pass laws, another massive blow. The government introduces something called Bantu education. Basically, an education system just for black people that's nowhere near as good as the white system. Bantu education is white supremacy in action. Teach black people only in their own language. Zulu, Sotho, Tswana, and not in the language of power, English. Teach them how to be laborers, to cement their status as second-class citizens. Basically, limit their potential.
The government's black education policy is inexplicably cruel. With average wages well below the poverty line, they're expected to pay $12 a quarter. Whites pay nothing. But as some apartheid supporters say, too many educated blacks would lead to frustration.
Too many educated blacks would lead to frustration. Let that sink in.
It was to divide and rule. You divide these people who are together as Africans, and they must start looking at themselves as Zulus and Sotho and Tswana. Typical divide and rule tactic to diminish, to reduce the strength, the power of a united African nation.
But it's not just a question of language. Bantu education also serves up a bunch of lies. It teaches black people an Afrikaner version of history. Now, Baba's a really smart guy, and he was a smart kid too, but there was one subject he failed.
And it was history, because I just hated the kind of things they were saying about natives as a country that had spaces that were empty and everybody arrived in South Africa at the same time. I just couldn't internalize that.
Spaces that were empty. When Baba says this, I think of Australia. It was the same tactics in my country, the very same playbook. Here, the lie of Terra Nullius took 200 years to expose. It was Eddie Mabo who forced Australians to face the truth. It took much longer in South Africa. As two young colonies in the 1800s, Australia and South Africa had a lot in common. Historian Roger Bell.
The relationship between Australia and South Africa was surprisingly very intimate, very friendly. Indeed, it was often termed a special relationship. The two countries were widely referred to as sisters of the South, largely because of their ideologies of race and racism and their institutionalizing of segregation and discrimination and denial of rights to people who were non-white.
Now, you might have picked up on some of the similarities between Australia and South Africa. Because yes, there was segregation here too. Aboriginal people were also forced off their land onto missions and reserves. And they also weren't allowed to vote, weren't allowed to sit with the white fellas at the pub, or swim in white-only pools. So I guess it's not that surprising that when apartheid's legislated in 1948, Australia's Prime Minister, Robert Menzies, stays besties with his sister of the South.
Indeed, he visited South Africa in 1953, and he was welcomed with banners pronouncing, "Welcome, Uncle Bob." Menzies epitomised the support for South Africa. No country did more to bolster white South Africa and to defend apartheid than did white Australia in the period of Menzies and Holt, and even through to Gorton and McMahon.
So why? Why does Australia back South Africa so strongly? Well, it's partly about shared racist values, partly about keeping the communists out, but mainly it's about money. South Africa is indispensable to the global economy. Its land is a treasure chest full of gold, diamonds, platinum, and shockingly cheap black labor. Apartheid is the engine room of mining. So many black bodies put on the line, generation after generation, shaping the lives of millions. Barbara Masekela, she's kind of like an auntie to me, and she'll go on to have an epic career as Nelson Mandela's chief of staff. But when she's a little girl, she's being raised by her grandmother.
All of us did not have parents because this was a great era for mining in South Africa. So our parents were all working on the reef.
The reef is the giant gold deposit in an area called the Witwatersrand that white people supposedly discovered and is the whole reason Johannesburg exists. More than half the gold ever mined comes from this reef, and thousands of African men have lost their lives in its deep tunnels.
We did not have grandfathers. Most of them were dead. So our grandmothers were forever in mourning. And what I recall is as a child seeing women in black all the time. One of the first experiences I had living with my grandmother in a mining town is the death of my uncle, who is killed because he was a cheeky native. He answered back. And that was not unusual. Neither was it unusual for men to leave home and not come back because they are arrested on their way home or wherever for passes. And this is a generation we don't speak about. These were people who were highly traumatized, who remembered living on lands that belonged to their clans, who remembered having kings. So we talk about the trauma of apartheid, but we don't talk about the trauma before apartheid.
They have a memory of dispossession, in a sense. Yeah.
They have a direct memory of dispossession, a direct memory of conquest. They being moved, dislocated. Those women of my grandmother's generation were women who had been raped regularly by farm owners. Nobody talks about it. So you are then raised by somebody like that, you know.
So many shared experiences of colonization and segregation and exclusion. So much hurt. My Auntie Barbara's story of dispossession and intergenerational trauma is as common in South Africa as it is here in Australia. But while not being able to go to the cinema or swim with white people is humiliating, I'm going to be real. For black people everywhere, hanging out with white people is the least of our worries. We're opposed to apartheid because of its violence, because it forces us from our lands and condemns us to poverty, inequality, and injustice. So, as we have since the beginning of colonization, we fight back. The British had promised black people the right to vote with the birth of the Union of South Africa. But, shock, horror, that doesn't happen. And so, in 1912, we form the African National Congress, the ANC. For decades, the ANC is a moderate lobby group. It's trying to convince white people that they can trust us to vote. But then in 1948, when the government launches those dreaded pass laws that you heard about earlier, the ANC launches the Defiance Campaign. Now, the campaign is led by this young, charismatic lawyer who's rising up through the ranks. His name is Nelson Mandela.
But he had a bit of a playboy image. Very good-looking man, married to Winnie, his beautiful woman, a lawyer, owned a car, socialized a lot, and with all the seriousness, bit of a playboy.
For years, Mandela urges people to peacefully protest the pass laws. And they do. They listen. But it's a pretty radical thing to be doing. Because, as journalist Benjamin Pogrund explains, the punishment for not carrying your identity pass with you at all times is brutal.
You could be standing at your front gate and a policeman would come by and say, "Pass," and you say, "It's in my jacket inside." Arrested. That's it.
In 1959, a breakaway activist group called the Pan-Africanist Congress, the PAC, splits off from the ANC. In March 1960, its charismatic leader, Robert Sobukwe, throws down the gauntlet. Leave your dompas at home. March to your closest police station and present yourself for arrest. A big crowd starts gathering outside the small police station that morning in the black township of Sharpeville, 60 kilometers south of Johannesburg. Thousands announce themselves to the police. They're asking to be arrested for not carrying a pass. The police tell them a government official is going to come and talk to them, and so the crowd waits. Women are ululating, singing in protest. It's passionate, but peaceful. Benjamin Pogrund's a young journalist with Johannesburg's progressive newspaper, the Rand Daily Mail, and he gets word that something's going down. He grabs a staff photographer and drives to Sharpeville.
There were crowds of black people on the side of the street shouting and booing at the police.
By the time Benjamin arrives, the protesters have worked out that the police are lying. There is no official coming to talk to them. Instead, the notorious security branch turns up, driving armed tanks into the crowd.
We started driving slowly around the crowd, and my photographer, Jan Hook, started shouting, "They're shooting, they're shooting."
We just heard a loud shot from the gunfire. From there, it was all hell.
At 1:30 p.m., with no warning, police fire 1,344 rounds into the crowd.
And I turned left towards the shooting, and Jan was yelling, "Their bodies all over, their bodies all over."
Everybody was running for safety, taking all directions. But then I was already shot. The bullet came through and got stuck on my spinal cord. It's still there. It was all blood behind these shops here.
69 people are killed by the cops that day. 180 are wounded. Almost everyone shot in the back as they run away in confusion.
I saw bodies on the ground, just littered. It was an astonishing sight. I mean, how does one describe a field with bodies all over the place? It was a horrifying sight.
Everybody in the country knew instantly that this has happened, this massacre had taken place, and the mood was really bitter. I mean, I just thought, no, this can't go on. We really have to do something. We were charged with emotion, we were angry.
The massacre awakened the world to the horrors of apartheid and sparked mass protest action.
Overnight, Sharpeville became the embodiment of evil, of racial oppression, and it galvanized the anti-apartheid movement throughout the world. South Africa became page one news throughout the world.
March 21st becomes known as the International Day for the Elimination of Racism. In Australia, you might know it as Harmony Day. The memory of a shocking event watered down and sanitized, which makes me very, very sad. But back in 1960, a line has been crossed, one that the world simply cannot ignore. The Sharpeville massacre changes how it sees South Africa. It also changes South Africa.
From then on, a new type of security came in, and they were vicious, and they stopped at nothing. Sharpeville was the dramatic turning point, externally and internally. It had a profound effect on what happened in South Africa.
The government immediately bans both the ANC and the PAC. The message is clear. Black dissent will not be tolerated. The UN condemns apartheid, and it encourages nations to cut ties with South Africa. Australian unions follow suit. In fact, they're some of the first in the world to call for trade sanctions. But Australia's Prime Minister, Robert Uncle Bob Menzies, holds his line. He stands firm with his sister of the South. Historian Peter Limb.
Prime Minister Menzies refused to condemn Sharpeville, and this was despite almost universal condemnation around the world. But Menzies had been called by apartheid's architect, Hendrik Verwoerd, as their best friend for not condemning the atrocity and for backing Pretoria in the UN. So it was pretty grim, but Sydney in particular, there were spontaneous protests. Police used force and they arrested quite violently trade unionists and students who were protesting the massacre.
The ANC has always firmly rejected the use of violence. But now, banned and backed into a corner, its young leaders push back against the ANC's older president, Chief Albert Luthuli. By this time, Nelson Mandela is the head of the ANC's Youth League, and he steps up and boldly makes a stunning announcement.
Mandela went underground and made an announcement that there comes a time in the life of an organization when it must decide whether to leave or die. The government wants to kill us. We have chosen to leave, to fight. We no longer can continue politics in the old way of marches, protests, demonstrations, and so on. But they're not listening to that. They'll have to listen to the bullets, to power.
The movement that's always disavowed violence changes course and goes underground. Umkhonto weSizwe, MK, the armed wing of the ANC, is born, the spear of the nation. Mandela and the ANC's other leaders disappear.
Mandela represented the struggle. They used to refer to him as the Black Pimpernel.
Every now and then, Mandela pops his head up, always secretly, never announced. The year after Sharpeville, my 20-year-old dad is at an ANC meeting in Pietermaritzburg when a buzz starts in the room. The Black Pimpernel emerges.
He addressed us. And we were so inspired that the guy had decided that we're not going to allow the struggle to die. It was absolutely impressive. And an hour later, he had disappeared and we didn't know where he went. But I mean, you can imagine how invigorating, how we were just pumped up. I can tell you, I became really radical.
In the early 1960s, Nelson Mandela travels across Africa, drumming up support for the new army. The ANC knows it can't fight the highly militarized apartheid regime without some serious financing. It looks to newly independent African states for money
and also the Soviets. In between missions, Mandela slips in and out of view. He sneaks into the country to see his wife Winnie and to touch base with other ANC leaders. He wears disguises, and every meeting is top secret. And Mandela stays in touch with journalist Benjamin Pogrund.
We had a method of contacting each other, and we met either at the home of a friend or more usually on a dark street corner in my car, and we sat for an hour or so talking. And a lot of trust developed between us because we were both putting our lives on the line. I would have been put in jail forever if I'd been caught with him. The whole police force were hunting him. He was known as a Black Pimpernel. It was almost a joke because here was this tall, imposing figure. His disguise was he was working a worker's overalls.
While Mandela's on the run canvassing support, Baba started studying at the legendary Black University, Fort Hare. It's where Africa's intelligentsia have been educated for years, and so naturally, campus is this hotbed of activism. But the students have to be very careful. The authorities have eyes everywhere. Baba's supposed to be studying pharmacy, but every day he's getting more and more deeply involved in the banned ANC.
You formed cells of five people, and each one of the five people would go and set up another cell of five to minimize security. You could know only the people in your cell. I was immediately invited to join the high command structure there, but it was just exciting that we are going to fight for our freedom.
Then one day,
you know, it was so shocking.
The worst news. Mandela has been captured. It's August 1962, and the Black Pimpernel's luck has finally run out. He's been on the run for more than a year, and he's just re-entered the country when he's ambushed by police in Natal. Mandela is detained and spends months in prison awaiting trial. A few months later, the ANC's secret hideout is raided and its entire leadership is arrested. They're accused of plotting to overthrow the government. Mandela is named as accused number one, the mastermind.
And it was so devastating. The documents that were seized there, one of them was Operation Maibuye, the blueprint for the struggle in South Africa, you know. Gosh, that crushed the revolution almost.
Some of the ANC's most confidential documents, including its plan for an armed uprising to bring down the government, are now in the hands of the apartheid regime.
At that point, I just thought, there is no way I can proceed to school. I've got to go and train. Military training abroad.
The ANC is in crisis. Its entire high command structure is now in prison, awaiting trial. Baba is just 22, but he has to act now. He starts planning his escape from South Africa to start training with Mkhonto we Sizwe, MK, the armed wing of the ANC. He knows he's taking a huge risk. It's not just police he has to worry about. Under apartheid, any white man can stop him at any time and ask for his dompas. Still, he forges ahead, keeping his plan to himself. When everything's ready, he disappears without telling a soul. Not his parents and not a single friend. Baba makes his way to Johannesburg and then takes a train to the Botswana border. And when he gets there, he'll still have to cross it on foot. It's an incredibly dangerous journey.
There were patrol vehicles at night. So we stood under the trees, and when it passed, we crossed carrying branches to make sure that they don't see the crossing into Botswana. But we were under instructions to destroy our dompasses as soon as we crossed, just to completely remove our identity and so on.
Can you describe how it felt when you crossed the border and burned that dompas? Did you feel somehow more dignity? Did you feel that you were going to miss home? How did it feel to cross that border?
Well, the first feeling was that of relief that we'd been able to cross the border without being detected, but also the sense that you're going to accomplish, change your life. It was quite clear that if you were caught, that would have been a serious, serious problem.
People who are caught are often shot on sight or returned to South Africa, tortured and imprisoned. The stakes are so high. But Baba makes it through the hardest part.
In no time, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I was on an Aeroflot flight to Russia, to Moscow.
Just a reminder that by now, 1963, we're right in the thick of the Cold War. And the ANC has close ties with the South African Communist Party, and therefore it has the support of the Soviet Union. It's a time when many of the African liberation movements are choosing sides. You either back the US and you say you love capitalism and freedom, or you choose socialism and economic progress for your people and you are embraced by the USSR. If you choose the Soviets, they'll train you, they'll feed you, and they'll clothe you. And they will definitely educate you.
And Baba, just when you're leaving to go to Russia, what do you think you're training for? You think you're going to carry a gun and blast into South Africa?
We trained in urban guerrilla warfare. We were going to be taught how to make homemade explosives to prepare us to go and use sabotage, which is urban guerrilla warfare, and quietly recruit people in South Africa who would carry out these things. We were able to handle guns from a revolver, pistol, submachine gun, machine gun, heavy machine, all the way to anti-aircraft things. I mean, it's the kind of thing that I thought was just superb.
Baba and his 22 ANC comrades are living out their boy's own adventure in an outlying suburb of Moscow. Their teachers in this top-secret, fast-track guerrilla training program are ex-Soviet Army officers, experts on explosives, topography, and communist theory. They can't tell anyone they meet why they're there, which isn't too hard because lots of Africans are studying in the Soviet Union, everything from medicine to teaching to armed guerrilla warfare. The Soviets are big on supporting the liberation movements fighting for independence from colonial powers. Meanwhile, back in South Africa, Nelson Mandela and his comrades face trial.
I have dedicated my life to this struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination.
Facing death, the Black Pimpernel delivers one of the most famous speeches in history.
I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society. It is an idea for which I hope to live for. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
Mandela is spared the death sentence. The regime knows that killing him will only make him a martyr. Instead, in 1964, at the age of 44, Mandela is sentenced to life in prison on the notorious Robben Island. It seems he really might die in his fight against white domination. With dissent banned and the hope of black people imprisoned, the brutality of the apartheid regime seems to know no end.
It just escalated. The laws changed, the detention without trial and people dying.
And then, just when it seems things can't get worse, they do. In 1966, the government starts forcibly removing black people from neighborhoods designated white only. They call them black spots. Those who remember still weep for their homes. Baba and his comrades spend an intense year doing their military training in the Soviet Union. When they first return to their transit camp in Tanzania, they naively think they'll be back in South Africa within a year. it's not long before they realize how hard it's going to be to fight their war. Tanzania is 3,000 kilometers north of Johannesburg. The logistical nightmare of crossing borders, avoiding authorities, feeding themselves, and staying on mission, that all begins to dawn on them. Baba has left his home to join a revolution that now seems stillborn. He has no idea how long it will be before he can get home, and no sense of how long it might take for South Africa to be free.
I didn't think about anything except that I was going to study, and possibly I was going to fight, and that we were going to win.
You just had no idea. You had no idea the win would be so long.
I had decided to go into revolution, and the cost was that of citizenship.
In his quest for his people's freedom, my father has given up his home. This season on Boycott, come with us inside one of the greatest resistance movements of our time.
It just escalated. The laws changed, the detention without trial and people dying.
We were a generation prepared to die for freedom.
Black South Africa rises up and people around the world join us.
The best way to do it is to starve that racist country of oil.
Free Nelson Mandela is one of those kind of songs. It was so full of life. It was so invigorating. It was so powerful. I mean, protest music you can dance to, that's always a good thing.
We started reading about these demonstrations that were being held involving these Australian anti-racists.
The demonstration is now getting quite violent. There are screams of pain and cries of pain coming up from the crowd from time to time.
Politics turns nasty on the rugby pitch.
There's a fullback McGill coming in, a chance here, there's a demonstrator on the field, and police are converging from anywhere.
It was such a clear case of terrible discrimination, whites-only teams. We thought that to the average Australian that would be despicable.
They're on the field, and the police cannot stop them.
The world stands up and bring South Africa to its knees.
All people were waiting for was for someone to kickstart a movement. And once it did, it got off the ground like a rocket.
Boycott was produced on the lands of the Nalama, Gadigal, Darug, the Jarawarung, and the lands of the Wajak people of the Noongar Nation. Our team of producers is Kirsty Melville, Sarah Alley, Kathy Peters, and Claudia Taranto. The sound engineer is Matthew Sigley. Our editor is Michelle Rayner. And original music is by Musa Diakate. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and this has been a Rewind production for ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.